Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's time for our weekly reporters roundtable. Joining us today, State House correspondent for the Associated Press, Julie Carr-Smythe. Welcome back, Julie.
Good morning, Ann.
And Columbus Dispatch State House reporter Jim Siegel. Welcome back.
Good morning.
And Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Karen Kessler. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Mike DeWine is running for Ohio governor.
What?
News.
No.
Newsflash.
My gosh. I had no idea that that would be happening.
In 2018, not to get anyone confused, fear not. The election is until 2018, but the primary will be next spring.
Right. That's
so it's coming right up, Julie Carr-Smythe.
It is. It's a widening field, I guess. We all knew DeWine would come in. He did so Sunday with a big announcement at his farm out in Cedarville.
His annual picnic.
Right, his annual ice cream social. And
that's
it's
right.
Just like classic Americana kind of situation. And, you know, he sort of laid out what he wants to do. And he pledges to have an agenda as the minute he walks in the door and be ready to go and keep Ohio going. I mean, obviously, these Republican candidates have a narrow path to walk here because they don't want to look like they're criticizing the current governor, but they have to say something new about what they're going to do for the state.
And all of them are current office holders, so
right,
they can't. They also have to be careful that they're not trashing each other too much.
Well, not. I mean, not all of them are statewide office holders.
Right.
You have Jim Renacci out,
the congressman.
Yeah, he tweeted out a little kind of gif yesterday of musical chairs at the state house, where it was. The three state office holders, Mike DeWine, Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor, and Secretary of State John Houston, playing musical chairs, implying that he would be different because he's not a sitting statewide office holder. He's a member of Congress, but he's still an elected official. So mm-hmm. four elected officials all running, that's different than what you have on the Democratic side.
Right. And they have to balance this issue of Donald Trump and sort of where it's a big mystery, really, to all the Republicans, how that election last year is going to play and how to navigate the next cycle after that. You know, do you align yourself with him? Do you distance yourself from him?
And does that matter more in the primary or basically just as much in the general election?
Well, I think it's going to be both. What we're seeing in Mike DeWine's entry into the race is he's such a classic traditional candidate. I had a piece yesterday basically talking about how in any other cycle, he would be the natural sort of the person you'd put your money on to win this. He's got extreme high name recognition, favorability as well among voters. He's got a long resume. He's kind of a law and order candidate, big happy family kind of.
But he's also a traditionalist.
Right. And so how that's going to play now, and we're seeing Houston, who's also somewhat of a traditional politician, kind of try to move to the right.
Mm-hmm.
Call in some of the lines from the campaign. You know, I'm part of the basket of deplorables, was in his first ad.
Mm-hmm.
And Renacci is taking it, you know, full tilt. He's hiring ex-Trump folks and positioning himself as a political outsider businessman, very similar to Trump.
The candidates in a primary, though, always move to the right in the case of Republicans and the left in the case of Democrats. Is that right, Jim Siegel?
Yeah, typically, because they try to eventually just try to outdo each other because they're, you know, they tend to not have a lot of fundamental disagreements. So it's about nuance and who sounds like they hate taxes more, for example. you know, that's often a theme, but. This will be a really interesting race. Like I said, Renacci's trying to position himself as the outsider versus the three longtime politicians. Although, I mean, really, I don't know how much voters are going to buy that a sitting congressman is somehow not a politician, but
or an outsider,
right? In some way. I mean, whatever works for you. You know, like I said, Renacci's on Trump is much more closely aligned with Trump than the others. You know, as Julie was saying, you know, Husted may have the best political mind of all the candidates, and is backed already by a number of what you would probably call your establishment Republicans. Mike DeWine probably has the best name ID of the four statewide, and then Mary Taylor is the lone female candidate, which does count for something, and she has charisma and she has, I think, an ability to go out there. She's backed by Kasich and has the ability to go out there and also run a strong campaign.
I think it's interesting what Jim is saying about the establishment Republicans that are backing Husted is very interesting. But I'm just wondering how DeWine and Husted kind of split that group, because obviously DeWine's very closely tied with somebody like former Governor George Voinovich, you know, and how many people who were big supporters of Voinovich would be drawn to DeWine, how many are being drawn to Husted. I think that there's potentially a split coming there, maybe a little bit. But also Mary Taylor, you know, there was a story that came out about her sons both having addiction issues with opioids, and this, I mean, it really demonstrated how this issue is affecting everybody. I wonder how that is going to play with her, and you know, are people going to see her as really understanding the issue because she's living it, or are people not going to see it that way? So I'm interested
because
to see.
She's a millionaire and. They can afford the best treatment available.
Well, and yes, she still opposes Medicaid expansion, which Governor Kasich has said has helped a lot of people through drug addiction. So I'm wondering how that's going to affect her campaign as well.
Well, and we'll begin fact-checking some of these campaigns, obviously. Mm-hmm. Things like...
Do you think this is it? I don't mean to interrupt you, but...
Well, anyone? Taylor isn't quite in yet.
She's not officially in, okay.
And that'll be interesting. But yes, I do think that after this, I don't... foresee, unless, you know, I mean, Cordray is still a little bit of a...
Well, that's the Democrat side, but on the Republican side,
Republican side, yes.
But go ahead.
I was going to say we'll begin to fact check some of these things. For example, DeWine's ad that comes out today talks about, hey, I'm taking on the pharmaceutical industry. And as we know, I mean, he waited 7 years until the month before he launched his campaign to file that suit. We also know that he's planning on taking on... the crisis of opioids, the most aggressively of any person. And yet we've seen most of our politicians fail thus far. The deaths and overdoses continue to rise. And, you know, they're trying their best in this current budget to put some resources toward it. But it's a huge mystery that I think is confounding everyone who's running the state right now.
I think, Jim Siegel, you've said it's going to be the issue.
What, the drug issue?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That'll definitely be one of the key issues. That, and I honestly think by the time we get to next year, I believe the economy and the jobs issue is going to rise back up again if we continue where we're trending on our state revenues. And that's kind of there are some who think this is foreshadowing maybe some economic problems, not just in Ohio but nationally. And so that could start to really – factor in again. And again, once again, we'll have to start talking about your economic message as much as anything else. But yeah, this is an interesting issue because in order to, you know, dealing with the drug crisis issue often means spending more taxpayer money to deal with it.
Right.
Something obviously Republicans do not like to do. And so it will be interesting to see how all the candidates kind of thread the needle on that. They don't want to make it sound like they've suddenly become big government Republicans on this issue. But at the same time, they have to also show that they're very serious about dealing with it. On top of what the legislature is going to pass this week in the budget, which is going to include additional money well on top of what Governor Kasich proposed.
Right. The issue of opioid addiction in Ohio, it's huge. I mean, regardless of where you sit politically, Mary Taylor in her in the story that came out in the Dayton Daily News a few weeks ago, she didn't really get into details about why. Do you think she's going to expand her story about her sons in campaigning?
I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. Some people might say that, you know, that these are privacy issues and that it's nobody's business. But it is really – it could potentially be really instructive to find out how it happens because, you know, most people probably know somebody who's dealing with it. But I think the whole idea of how it happens and how two kids could have this happen to them is – it would be very interesting, I think, to a lot of people. Yeah. But there's obviously going to be a political calculation here. I mean, her campaign sent out that Dayton Daily News story to make supporters aware of it and right after it was put out there. So, you know, obviously it's something that she's, you know, had to embrace and say that this is my situation.
I suspect she won't talk about it much more because of what happened with that story. It looked as if they made a calculation to tell the story once, do the full bore with the and presumably Dayton found out about it and approached her. And so they said, let's tell the whole story. Let's go on video and say it. And then when we all went and said we'd also like interviews, they said, no, it's a private matter. And so she probably doesn't want to make her personal story the entire thing for the reason that it, her sons
it's
and how it affects them.
It's understandable. Any right. human can understand it, but...
But
it exactly. could be instructive. And well, she does have a very specific stance on spending for it.
Yeah.
Medicaid spending.
Exactly. And she's I think she's going to get pressed. I don't whether she'll talk about it or not, I don't
right.
know. But I think she will definitely be pressed for more detail on exactly how they became addicted. Where did they get the drugs from? What did they start with? Where did they end with? How
What's
did
the it, lesson what, here? Yeah.
How did it all occur?
And treatment.
And what treatment did they get? And how were, you know, what about those who don't have the kind of financial resources that they have? What do they do?
Right.
She's obviously been a tremendously outspoken opponent of Obamacare, which, of course, includes the Medicaid expansion, although she hasn't talked as much about that. So I think she's going to get pressed. And this argument of it's a private matter, you can't go to the Dayton Daily News and spill everything and then turn around and say, well, now it's private. So that is mm-hmm. that I don't think is going to be a good response.
I think there was no way that with opposition research being what it is, that this wasn't going to be found out
right.
at some point.
Mm-hmm.
So telling the story maybe gave her the opportunity to get in front of it and own it. But here's the thing that I hate to bring up, but it always seems to come up when women run for office, is the idea of this is her family. And there are going to be people who are going to say she should leave the race to deal with a family issue, which is not the same thing that a lot of male politicians would get. And it's very, very frustrating. But I think that's
you know,
there's
that
an element
even
that's
occurred
out there.
To me. Maybe that's how things have changed. I mean, it hadn't occurred to me that would be the case.
Unfortunately, I think it's real. I think it really is something that people would say about a woman running for office that they might not say about
yeah,
a man. And
right.
and it's I think it's a reality that she's unfortunately going to have to face. It's less problematic maybe than it used to be, but I think it's still out there.
Yeah.
I just don't think one thing's been brought up that has been on my mind, which is when Kasich came out after this with his statement, he indicated he had known about it for quite some time, probably over a year at least.
Uh-huh.
And that's the second family of Ohio. They described it as they had been in crisis frequently for over a year. And I wonder about why they didn't go public with it at some point. Not because she's running for office, but because she holds a very high role in this state.
Yeah.
Right. Not even just a bully pulpit, but I mean, if your second family is in crisis, I mean, I guess we can say the lieutenant governor doesn't have that much to do or something, so it's not as big a deal as if it were the governor, but there was sort of an honesty, openness, transparency issue to me.
Well, and there were a lot of stories that were coming out of the last year or two about you know, some situations in her office that she wasn't there or whatever, you know, some of those
right.
kind of situations, it makes you maybe look back on those and think maybe she wasn't as available because she was dealing with something in her family, because obviously her family's not here in Columbus.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a thought.
Right.
And of course, to let listeners know, their sons are both adults.
Yes.
They're grown. Of course, you know, you once a child, you know, you're always your child, but I get that. But they're not young children or teenagers or something like that. Yeah. Jim Siegel, did you?
Yeah. No.
We are going to take a break. We will continue our weekly reporters roundtable. Questions or comments, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you could email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're going to turn to the state budget, maybe a little bit on the Democrat side with politics. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Well, Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporters roundtable. Still with us, State House correspondent for the Associated Press, Julie Carr-Smythe, Columbus Dispatch State House reporter, Jim Siegel, and Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Karen Kassler. Questions, comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And just turning quickly back to Mary Taylor, we have a call from Adam in Columbus. Hi, Adam, you're on the air.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
I was just wondering if you had given any thought to the fact that it seems like all these Republicans are trying to show their credentials on the battle against opiate abuse. A week after DeWine announces his lawsuit, Mary Taylor all of a sudden announces that her family's been having all these problems. Not saying that she's lying, but the timing on this seems awful coincidental. Have you thought about that at all?
Well, we were kind of talking about that as far as things are going to come out, right? If it's out there. She hasn't officially announced for her run for governor, but she's expected to. Julie Carr-Smythe?
I felt like we don't actually know whether that timing was her choice, because the newspaper released it when they released it, and they may have seen it as timely related to the lawsuit, but it may not have been her particular day. I mean, obviously, they took that video at some point and pushed it out when they did, so I don't really think for sure. It wasn't like a campaign announcement or something. It was a news story. So I guess when you get Laura back on here, you can ask her, but I'm not quite sure.
Okay. Thanks, Adam, for that call. I wanted to turn to one of a related issue, and that is the GOP Senate health care bill. It's supposed to repeal, I guess, or repeal many parts of and replace, I guess, with something, the Affordable Care Act. Governor Kasich criticized the Senate health care bill on Sunday on CNN State of the Union. Let's hear.
You know what? Both parties ought to be worried about poor people, because I don't think either party particularly cares about helping poor people. You look at the rates of poverty. You look at the problems in this country. We have not designed a system to get people work. Everything we're talking about now, getting people healthy, giving them health care, is designed to get them to work. It's designed to give them an opportunity to have a better life.
So he was highly critical. There's at least five moderate Republicans in the Senate that are saying they can't vote for the bill as is. What does that mean, Julie Carr-Smythe?
Well, I think that the current bill is going to have to be significantly revised to get through the Senate. But obviously,
not to mention the House.
Right. But the thing is that these folks have made this a key promise. Most of them are hinging their future in politics on repealing Obamacare. So they're between a rock and a hard place. They're not getting very consistent messages from the White House or much help. So I think it's going to be an interesting week to see how. I mean, Mitch McConnell seems to think he can get the votes eventually.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder, though, for all those years that they were voting to repeal Obamacare, what was it, 60 times? What was the plan? I keep hearing the phrase about the dog caught the car. Okay, the dog caught the car.
Right.
Now what?
Right.
And so it does make you wonder where, in all those times that they did vote to repeal, the House did, what was happening behind the scenes that amongst leadership saying, hey, if we ever get this opportunity, what will we do? And, you know, now we're finding out.
And you mentioned earlier, I think you said something about moderate senators. I think it's actually the conservative block of senators that is opposed
both,
to this.
I think it's both then.
Well,
yeah.
there's a block of four very conservative senators, including Rand Paul and Ted Cruz.
There's
and
the
some
Susan
others.
Collins, though. And
yeah,
the,
but she hasn't come out, I don't think, specifically yet. The only one I think has come out specifically on the moderate side is Heller from Nevada. And he's already what's maybe a little bit self-defeating. Trump's folks are going after him on TV ads, attacking him in his own state, a state that Hillary Clinton won, by the way. So that will be interesting to see how that ends up working out. But you've got a whole group of senators, Rob Portman being one of them, Murkowski and she's Alaska, I believe.
Right.
And then you've got, you know, Susan Collins, like you mentioned.
Yeah.
There's a senator in West Virginia. West Virginia gets more Medicaid per pupil per person, I think,
Manchin?
Than anyone. No, well, Joe Manson's he's the Democrat.
Yeah, okay. That's
but
right.
I forget the Republican's name. But
he's
anyway,
a
there's a whole group, and I think once you see the Congressional Budget Office scoring of this, which I think is coming today, if I recall, today mm-hmm. or tomorrow, and once that may I know that Rob Portman is among those waiting for that to come out before he really takes a firm position, and I can't imagine this is going to be much better looking than the ones from the House, and so that you might see some more of those moderates fall off, and they may be even further away.
And the bottom line score everybody's looking for at the outset, at least, is how many people will lose coverage, or who will for whom coverage will become unaffordable with this new plan.
Right. And I heard some criticism over the weekend of Kasich that was interesting, that, you know, he's obviously quite impassioned about this. But some of the folks who are supporting the bill are saying, you know, these governors who of both parties who have come out and said, let's salvage Obamacare and fix it. Let's stop trying to repeal the whole law. Are saying, well, you know, it's easy to say that you want Medicaid to continue because that's federal money that comes in that's balancing your budgets that you don't have to find elsewhere.
Well, but the state did expand. I mean, they can just contract.
Right. They can.
Take away.
But 700,000 people.
Take away.
And that's a lot, especially people who are in they're very, very low income. They wouldn't be able to go out and just get insurance. And a lot of these folks are drug addicted, mentally ill. And so for the state to have to accept that financial burden, the Center for Community Solutions did a study back earlier this year that said, I mean, we're talking about $2.5 billion at least that would be involved in taking those people on if Medicaid expansion were ended. And so I think Kasich, you know, when he speaks passionately about Medicaid expansion, he's very worried not only about those people maybe, but also about what it would do to Ohio's budget. And we already were $841 million short in terms of income tax collections. Mm-hmm. There was some cutting that had to be done in the budget that will be voted on this week. What if you had to cut another $2 billion to try to take care of people who lost their Medicaid expansion coverage?
Yeah, for some perspective, that expansion population, I think right now it's 95% is being paid by the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
The state is kicking in very little, and that is why there is such an impassioned plea from John Kasich and some other governors to keep this going, because the state, if it were to drop to the normal matching rate from the feds, which I think is like around 60-65%. If it were to drop to that, that would, like Karen said, that would cost us, you know, probably over $1 billion
well,
easily.
And it hasn't just been a big, giant government entitlement expansion. I mean, Ohio's Medicaid efforts are well known nationally. I mean, they're working hard
to figure out. Medicaid bill came in lower.
It's right. One of the reasons that the state, even though we are $841 million as of right now, short in terms of income tax collections, the budget office keeps saying we're going to end this fiscal year in the black because of underspending in Medicaid. So, yeah,
because of Medicaid reforms and how they meted out.
Right. And just efficiencies and figuring out smart ways to get these programs to people without wasting money. So they've tried to really take the bulk out of it as much as they can. And I think we're kind of a national leader on that.
One of the criticisms you do hear, though, from conservatives is that while Medicaid underspending continues, the actual number of people on the expansion over 700,000 is roughly triple the initial estimates that the administration was putting out there when they originally passed this back in, I think it was 2014.
You mean in Ohio?
Yes.
Okay.
So that, you know, there's some saying, look, this thing is way bigger than we ever envisioned it would be. And that concerns conservatives who don't like that. Obviously, we are whether it's federal money or not, we're growing government.
It's interesting. I mean, this isn't directly connected, but it does suggest there's a connection between that higher number of Medicaid qualifying people in Ohio and the low rate of tax revenue in Ohio, despite, you know, however it rebounded from the recession the way it did, the jobs aren't paying enough to bring in tax revenue or make enough to afford health care coverage.
Right. I think that the statistics would show that the wages are less, even though the jobs are back, essentially. They're not the same level with good paying benefits. all of them. So
the Cincinnati Inquirer did a gritty look at the revenue shortfall with Budget Director Tim Kaine recently, and that's what they're finally saying. It's not just sort of this, the money just didn't come in and we're not sure why it didn't come in kind of a thing. Now they're saying clearly that it has to do with the wages. Low.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. There's also, but we're also, tax refunds are up 25% over estimates. That's not a wage problem.
Which brings us to the small business
right.
Tax cut.
Right.
That's
other issues.
That Governor Kasich has said he doesn't want to let go of that. He wants to keep it.
Well, I mean, there's an attitude that if you do pull that back, and this is a small business tax cut that allows small businesses like sole proprietorships and partnerships,
like a self-employed lawyer,
yeah, to deduct. Yeah. If you're reporting your revenue as personal income, you can deduct up to the first $250,000. And the Department of Taxation says it's about a little over $1 billion that cost the state. Well, there's an argument: did it cost the state? This was their money to begin with, you know. But
yeah,
anyway,
right.
That's what you're
Whatever.
Saying. But you know, I think there are a lot of people who would see it as, well, if you pull that back, are you raising taxes? If you close that income tax cut, are you raising taxes? There are those who would say that is a tax increase.
That they're then worried about what goes on in their campaign literature,
absolutely,
not about what's in the best interest of the state.
Well, and yeah, I mean that there's the state was about $1 billion short. You know, Tim Kaine in the budget office says the small business tax cut is not the reason for that $1 billion shortfall. But there was $1 billion that went to this. And the other side of that is how many jobs were created? What did it actually do to spark the economy and do the things that it was supposed to do when it was first enacted?
And there so far is no evidence it has done anything to create jobs.
Well, right. But I do think that John Kasich's anger does go back to I think he sees his party and did all of last year as putting some rhetoric out there that it can't back up. I mean, this whole idea of government is bad and get government out of our business. I think when he makes these pleas about, you know, the most vulnerable, he's trying to make a case as articulately as he can about a certain validity to government's role there. There are some of them who, like you say, whether it's campaign literature or belief that's in their heart about government, I mean, they're definitely caught there because, you know, they can't expand government and keep their campaign promises.
Yeah, I mean, getting rid of this would be a tax increase. That's to me, there's little debate about that. But I can tell you there are definitely Republicans in the legislature, some I've quoted in stories, some I haven't, who are supportive of at least partially rolling back this business income tax deduction. And it's not just the $250,000. The $250,000, you don't pay any income tax on that. Every dollar you make above $250,000, you get a 40% tax cut on. You pay 3% on that instead of 5%. That, to be honest, that is the portion that is causing, I think, more heartache and heartburn than any of it.
Why
because
is that?
That is a very specific tax cut aimed at the wealthy. There's really no other way to describe it. It's if you're making over $250,000 a year,
you're doing okay.
And that alone, that part of it is, that's a tax break for the wealthy. And that is a lot harder to defend. And Republicans, when you talk to them privately, admit that. That part of the tax plan especially, and that's not a small part. The Legislative Service Commission recently said that up to 40% of the $1.1 billion that's going to this, up to 40% of it is because of that tax break over $250,000.
Right. And a sole proprietorship, let's say, is a person.
Could it be a
right.
dentist? Could it be a lawyer?
Yeah.
Could it be a real estate agent?
Yep.
Could it be a developer?
A lobbyist?
A doctor.
A doctor.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard some grumblings. I mean, I've heard lobbyists who roll their eyes at me when I talk about this and the fact that they're getting this windfall of tax break. They're like, I don't understand why I'm getting this. I don't, you know. But they're taking it. But I've also heard that some of the lobbyists say, yeah, the reason this is not going away is because not because of the us in the room, it's all the lawyers and all the friends of the lawmakers who are also highly paid attorneys and other things.
Insurance
and other things that are, you know, friendly with lawmakers who really like getting this tax break. So.
Well, and I think twice now Kasich's budgets have tried to impose fees on professional services like lobbying and lawyers, and those things have fallen so flat.
Mm-hmm.
They can't get it to go. So it's actually gone in the other direction for the folks who are having a lot of influence, wielding a lot of influence downtown.
Yeah, and the Senate Republicans got up on the floor this last week and defended the tax break because the Democrats got up and tried to they in the Senate proposed to get rid of it, get rid of the business income tax deduction and instead either spend it on different programs or do it in a way that would target tax cuts more to middle and lower class folks. But they got up and defended it, but a lot of the defense you hear, if you listen closely to what they say, it's not so much a defense of the business income tax cut. It's a defense of general tax cuts. I mean, there's a general, philosophy, and it's fine. From Republicans that, people can spend their money better than government. We should have as low as taxes as possible, and which that is fine. However, that does not defend a business-specific tax cut. That does not defend why the attorney gets a tax cut while his secretary does not. That does not equate that argument. So.
Well, and you'll remember that back in 2010 when Kasich was running, I mean, his goal was to get rid of the income tax in Ohio.
Right.
I mean, he had always wanted to do that, which would obviously be an across-the-board benefit as opposed to what they've wound up delivering. They can still put it on their campaign literature that they've cut income taxes, but it's very targeted now.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, this is $2.2 billion over a two-year budget is what we're kind of looking at. And there's, this is not chump change that we're talking about here.
And going back to the point you made about Governor Kasich making his argument about government, there is a reason for government. I mean, the argument that people can spend their money better than government can is fine unless you're talking about curb cuts, unless you're talking about bridges, unless you're talking about managing the state Medicaid system, managing state prisons, managing all the goods and services that state brings to you. Individuals can't do that kind of thing.
That they're societal. I mean, when they tried to make the most severe sort of tax, you remember that tax debate a few years ago with Ken Blackwell about taking it down to the bare minimum? I think the bare minimum that the most conservative Republicans supported was roads, law enforcement. Is there anything else that we need? No. And that was called I forget. Tabor. It was the Tabor, the tax something.
Yes.
Yeah. And we had a ballot initiative that didn't really go anywhere. But yeah, I interviewed the guy who sort of invented that, and it was fascinating to hear him out in Colorado talk about how, that's really all we think we need from the government is a transportation system and law enforcement.
We don't need regulation. We don't need environmental.
I think the Constitution would say that we have a school system we need to fund.
Well,
as
maybe.
Well.
There's that minor detail. But it doesn't say how much.
Thorough and efficient.
Well, because that was at the time at the height of.
It doesn't define it either.
Doesn't define it. Why would it do that?
It was at the height of the homeschooling movement, too. So, I mean, some folks don't advocate money on that.
We will continue our conversation. This is our weekly reporters roundtable. If you have a question or comment, give us a call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. You've dropped in on our weekly reporters roundtable. Still with us, State House correspondent for the Associated Press, Julie Carr-Smythe. Columbus Dispatch Statehouse reporter Jim Siegel and Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Karen Kassler. Again, we'll open with a caller. Robert and Powell, you're on the air. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
There are two things about Kasich I'm not buying. Number one, he's like the new Bobby Kennedy, the pleader for the poor. And I could be wrong, and your commentators can tell me if I am, but it seems to me much of his time in office has been giving big breaks to corporations to do business here in the Ohio area. And number two, I'm not buying that he's not running for president. His hair looked real good on CNN. No cowlick.
He's no working cowlick. On his hairstyle now. Okay, it Robert. Was, I didn't see that. I'll have to go back and check that out. But let's talk about, you know, my recollection of John Kasich since he's been running for governor, there's been sort of these dueling streaks, this tax cut thing, income tax cut. And but there's also always been this the people in the shadows, take care of the people in the shadows sort of a thing. Yeah.
My take on that is that he is accurate, that it's not entirely altruistic. I think that Kasich really would do anything to make sure his budget, that any budget that he touches is balanced and that it looks robust. I mean, what we saw, which was unprecedented back in April, was when he thought there was going to be a deficit, he pulled together all the leaders and he got in front of it and he said, here's what we're going to do about it. I mean, he does not want to touch a budget that doesn't look responsible, because that's his stock in trade to question too if he wants to run again. You know, he was the great budget balancer back when he was in Congress. And so I do think that that is certainly a factor. But I will also say that just in personal interviews with him, he describes that he's matured as a person. At a certain point in his adult life, he found God. And I think it's a very common and consistent theme with him that, you know, all of us, not just in government, but as people, need to help people who are less fortunate.
Well, I think there is a little bit of having it both ways, though, with him, because, I mean, for instance, Medicaid expansion, you know, this allowed him to extend coverage to people in the shadows, as you put it, and as he has put it several times.
Right.
But with using federal money through a law that he was very clear that he didn't support.
So he didn't support Affordable Care Act, but he supported the Medicaid expansion.
Right. And you know, there was a lot of wrestling back and forth of, well, isn't that Obamacare? Well, it is part of Obamacare, but that doesn't mean that he supported it. That's what he had been talking about when that was happening. So I think he does.
How soon I forget.
But I think the caller makes an interesting point that there is kind of a little of having it both ways. He's done a lot of tax cutting, and as Julie said and Jim said, targeted tax cutting for the people at the top end of the scale, but then extending some things for folks at the lower end of the scale, including Medicaid expansion. But, you know, at some point, all these things do have a cost to them. And, you know, the whole idea of that goes back to what we were talking about before, about the Trump care, as some people call it, whatever the Affordable Care Act is going to be repealed and replaced with, if it ever happens. If that ends Medicaid expansion, that's going to be a serious problem for the budget.
So is he running for president again? You know, some people say he might be running for a slot on CNN, too, Jim Siegel.
Well, it could be. He's trying to carve out his lane. I mean, you don't go on TV and say things like neither party cares about poor people unless you're trying to, unless you've got some type of a longer term agenda. You know, and whether it's on CNN or running for president.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
He was on The View a couple times, too. So maybe that's what he's looking
wow,
at.
Wow, working
know.
On those
well, he's
voters.
Also still selling a book, too. So
true.
Don't forget
that's
that.
True. Yeah,
but
that's
he
right.
doesn't – I don't think he wants to become obsolete and
yes.
irrelevant. And he knows that he's term limited. He's trying probably to decide, as we know, with the last time he waited to the last minute to decide.
Well, I imagine there's a lot of governors out there, though, that would like to be on The View or on CNN or any of that kind of stuff. I mean, they must like him, too, if they're bringing him back.
Well, and certainly the whole kinder, gentler Kasich is a political there is a political calculus in doing that. Obviously, he tried in 2016 to make that his stock in trade, to distinguish himself from the field. It didn't quite work, but I think that it it caught on in his mind.
His support for Mary Taylor is unequivocal. I mean, could he? Does that mean he's going to be out there running, you know, helping her run against the other candidates necessarily? Or what do you make of that?
I don't know. I wonder how many Republicans in Ohio are still smarting over what happened last year.
Because he didn't endorse
Because
Trump.
He didn't endorse Trump.
Yeah.
And Trump won Ohio. And I wonder how his – whatever he says in next year's gubernatorial campaign, if that's going to help or hurt Mary Taylor, if it's going to help or hurt anybody else in the race, if it's even going to make a difference. I mean, we're now in that kind of post-endorsement era where nobody seems to care what endorsements and who is in favor of you or whatever.
Right.
I don't know how it's going to play
I just
for
wonder
her.
If it might help in fundraising, and that's about it. But I don't even know how she's doing there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it will help her in fundraising. But, you know, just the dynamics of this, I mean, Jim Renacci being so close to Trump, that's Kasich is not going to want to, you know, back
touch
him.
That, right?
It's well known. Kasich and Husted are not on each other's Christmas card lists, let's just say.
Uh-huh.
And I really don't know that how his feelings about Mike DeWine. I don't know that there's any animosity there, but I just don't know.
I don't think that Mike DeWine would necessarily need his endorsement.
Anyway,
I
mean, because Mike DeWine's Mike DeWine, yeah.
Right.
I want to switch gears just a little bit. The Dispatch, a really interesting story yesterday. Were you at the byline on that with Kathy Kandiski on the opioid, compassion fatigue?
Oh, no. That was Marty Schladen.
Sorry about that. Knew it started with this S. but it was a major theme in Mike DeWine's announcement this weekend as far as opioid crisis goes. We've already talked about how it's going to be an issue. And I was just wondering, could this compassion fatigue extend to the public's willingness to support treatment? I mean, is this?
I think it's already happening.
Yeah,
You'll hear, and you know, these. Of course, this is anecdotal. You know, people expressing concern of, well, how come Narcan is free for the drug addicts, but my insulin isn't free?
Right.
You know, and that's a really frustrating attitude because these things are not comparable, and it's just. But I think that there's already some of that happening, and there's among people who maybe the opioid crisis hasn't hit hard, they're not seeing what other people are seeing. I think some of the stories that law enforcement are telling are just unbelievable, and those are the stories that I think folks should be reading to find out what it's like for these first responders, these people who are dealing with these addicts.
We're asking them to then show up and watch people die.
Right.
At the rate of, I think in Columbus, they're using Narcan about 8 to 7 times a week alone in Columbus alone.
And people like Children's Services and folks who are dealing with the impact on the families, on the children of this crisis. It's a serious concern.
And it's not a typical – it's not your grandmother's OD, if you want to put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not sort of a – I mean, there is a chemical issue going on with these opioids.
They're different.
That are different and that are – uncontrollable almost in terms of the addiction. And as we were saying earlier, I think that it's a confounding problem. But when you start to see people literally just dropping like flies across your state and across the country.
541, over 4,000 people so far this year, so far.
That was last year's total.
Last year's total.
But yeah, it's.
Although they're well ahead of pace this year again.
Right. All right. Now, the Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow has said that it will have to lay off 350 people to help pay a $60 million debt to the state. The courts have said you owe the money, you got to pay it. There's a question about whether they can cut a deal with the state and go to kind of payment plans or something like that. Jim Siegel, what's going on?
Well, a payment plan is likely. I mean, the state has already offered a 2-year payment plan, mm-hmm. and that's, you know, and frankly, just from what all the people I've talked to and how long have I've watched this, I frankly thought that might be extended a little longer. I thought 2 years was probably going to be, I was expecting more like 3 or 4. But they're being asked to pay this money back now. There are, of course, the cynical among us who see this as, this announcement by ECOT as just an effort to try to win over some more public support and get some public sympathy. You know, we had a story that right after they made this announcement, we ran a story 2 days later that talked about how, despite the fact that they're talking about doing all these layoffs, they're still spending six figures, seven figures on television ads to basically right. try to encourage people to go after the, you know, and call the legislature and tell them to stop picking on us. And mm-hmm. So these, you know, these are no longer promotional ads. These are political ads. And Dave Yost even stepped up now. And it's gotten to the point where Dave Yost, who is a supporter of ECOT, stepped up and said, yeah, this is not proper. You should not be doing this. So
in other words, they're spending state money that's given to them. It's paid to them to educate children on ads to argue against the legislature
against
and
the state.
The Ohio Department
at the
of
same
Education.
Time, they're also paying $22 million a year to companies owned by Bill Lager, the founder of ECOT. And that's not That's not just money that he's turning around and spending on teachers. That's actual just. That's like most
that's
of that money.
Is,
most of that money is going to his software company for, you know, software licenses. I mean, like $17 million.
He's
a
got
year.
A vertical.
So there's no talk of reducing that amount.
Yeah.
But we're talking about laying off 350 right. you know, teachers. So it's kind of a wait and see thing. We're expected to see a state appeals court decision soon on that case as well.
And the lawsuit also is funded essentially by tax dollars because they're funded by tax dollars.
Right. Yeah, I mean the state is paying for both.
We're paying both sides of this lawsuit.
Both sides.
Yeah. So we're paying both sides of the lawsuit. We're paying for, you know, the ads that are running to beat up the law, the Department of Education and lawmakers. We're paying
for the Department of Education.
We're paying for the Department of Education to go after ECOT. Mm-hmm. So taxpayers, you're just this is costing you a lot of money, regardless of no matter what happens.
You're spending like you're loaded out there, all because of ECOT, Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow. Not to mention, they also have pretty high paid lobbyists working for them and that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Yes. Again,
yes,
paid
they,
for.
They have the Batchelder Company, which is named after the former House Speaker Bill Batchelder. Which is their lobbying firm. Neil Clark is their spokesman and lobbyist. He is a well-known veteran State House lobbyist.
Been around the block a few times.
And you know, the whole thing comes about because they inflated their student attendance by significant mm-hmm. by 9,000 kids. They said they had 15,000 full-time students. They inflated that by 9,000. And, you know, I guess if ECOT were doing really, really well in terms of graduating kids and that sort of thing, maybe this wouldn't be as big a concern. But their graduation rate is below 40%. It's right around 39%. And that's a real concern because it's, you know, that's way below the constant criticism is, well, you know, look at the public schools. The public schools don't do that well. Well, the graduation rate in public schools is a lot better.
It's a lot higher.
Yeah. And ECOT's,
and they have to take everybody.
Yeah. And ECOT's the ninth largest district in Ohio, just by sheer numbers, though. If you shave off the 9,000 students, I don't know where it falls.
That's right. Yeah. That kind of changes that equation a little bit.
But maybe and I wonder, you know, if you're going to lay off 350 staff members, how can you come back and still claim that you have 15,000 full-time students or whatever they're claiming? I mean,
who's going to teach
yes,
all these kids
exactly.
you're claiming you have? All right. So we just have 2 minutes. Really, let's call it a minute. What are you going to be looking for this week, Julie Carsmyth?
Well, Mike DeWine Mike DeWine launched his governor tour today, and the budget obviously is facing its deadline on Friday to get out of the legislature.
Right. It's got to go all the way through.
So we have the conference committee continuing, and we'll see where there are some pieces of it that are really going to be interesting. The extent of the Medicaid expansion, the taxes, some of the things we've talked about here.
And Jim Siegel, budget?
Yeah,
all day, every day?
Yeah, the conference committee scheduled for today has already been canceled, so that tells you where the negotiations are right now. So they'll come back, probably try it tomorrow. This is going to be a very tight window for the governor by the time he gets this budget. They're currently fighting, the House and Senate are debating a number of issues, Medicaid oversight of rates, the Medicaid expansion freeze that the Senate put in. There's wind farm regulations. There's fixing the MCO tax for local governments, counties, and transit. So there's a lot of things still to work out.
You have 15 seconds.
I thought you were going to tell me, Jim, that it was canceled today because things were going so well they don't need the conference committee today.
But, right.
Also, once the budget actually gets through and gets to the governor, line item vetoes will be very interesting to watch as well. But that we won't see those till Friday.
Yeah, look in your Saturday morning paper. Thank you for joining us, Karen Castle. I appreciate your time.
It's very nice to be here with Columbus Monthly's best radio personality. There you go.
So personality. Thank you very much. Also, Julie Carr-Smyth, State House correspondent for the Associated Press.
Thanks for having me.
And Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.